And our sermon text today is Psalm 125, a song of ascent. Psalm 125. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. The mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forevermore. For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good, and to those who are upright in their hearts. But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away with evildoers. Peace be upon Israel. In June of 1567, the Reformation in Scotland seemed doomed. Queen Mary, Queen of Scots she was, had married a Catholic husband after plotting to have her previous husband murdered. And on top of this, she was secretly plotting with the French, too. Dastardly woman, plotting with the French to succeed the staunchly Protestant Queen Elizabeth I after her death. She would then be Catholic queen of both England and Scotland. This was abhorrent to most Scots who had spent the better part of the last several decades throwing off the yoke of both the English and the French oppression. The fiery preaching and leadership of John Knox helped to establish the Church of Scotland independent of any king, queen, or parliament, foreign parliament. The basic system of Presbyterianism extant in the OPC, for example, was established, and established here in Scotland. Local congregations ruled by a session of elders, whose congregations were accountable then to regional presbyteries, who were in turn accountable to a national general assembly, which was then accountable to the body's head, Jesus Christ. With blood, we have martyrs like Hamilton and George Weishart, whose readings and whose example influenced John Knox. John Knox was a Catholic priest before these things. He started reading Calvin and Weishart and Hamilton, saw their example to their martyrdom, burned at the stake, both of these men. With blood then, with imprisonment, did you know that John Knox was a galley slave for 19 months, captured in a battle and thrown into the ships of France? Persecution, countless Protestants throughout Scotland. Well, the independent Scots had bought their freedom. The Scottish Parliament had set forth a directory for worship and confession of faith, much of which would form the basis for the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, too, here in Scotland. With the support of the French and a few Scottish clans, Mary stood to battle at Carberry Hill, then on June 15th of that year. Gathered together against her, that is with John Knox present there as chaplain for the troops, was a confederation of Scottish clans determined to conserve their Protestant gains against the imposition of the Roman Mass, the rule of the papacy, and France. They spent the better part of that morning in worship and in song, preparing for battle. Guess which was one of their featured psalms as they did so in this worship service, and with which they went into battle, Psalm 125. Now, I had set a different course for this message, but as I did my research in the course of the week, I ran across this psalm popping up time and again in the lives of the Scots. And so Kathy was very gracious and helped me call that audible. And in the middle of the week, we changed what the psalm would be. Dean said, that's okay, just don't do it too often. But this psalm I just found to be so vital to the Scots. And since we're on the psalms, I thought we could do this. Well, in the course of that day, the Protestant Confederation of Clans would defeat Mary in the French Catholic coalition. In fact, Mary herself would be captured, imprisoned, her son James VI, who would soon become James I of England, the James of the King James Bible, would be crowned king of both England and Scotland, James I. Guess who preached the coronation sermon? It was John Knox. Guess what was one of the psalms sung at the ceremony, the coronation ceremony? Yes! Ours today, Psalm 125. It is, as one historian puts it, one of the most popular psalms of the Scottish Reformation, whether sung in family, field of battle, or form of liturgy, unquote. Why do you think this might be true for Psalm 125? Let's look to our psalm today and discover why, shall we? I have it in three, it comes in three different sections, this psalm does, so we have three different points to make. Redoubt. You know what a redoubt is? I will give you this in the course of the sermon. Defensively, no enemy is able to ravage God's people, verses 1 and 2. Defensively, no enemy is able to ravage God's people. Psalm 125 is one of the songs of ascent, encompassing Psalms 120 through 134. Scan your text again and see the truth of this. Of course, we treated of Psalm 124 a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? As we highlighted for you in our exposition of Psalm 124, these would be sung as the pilgrims of Israel's congregation would be ascending the hill of the Temple Mount towards the entry to the temple on Mount Zion. Thus, its rubric, a song of ascents. Trudging upwards toward the top of the hill Zion, the object of their pilgrimage, on which sat the Temple of Solomon in the pre-exilic period, and of course the Herodian Temple in the post-exilic period, it would be natural to sing, "Those who trust in Yahweh are like Mount Zion," as they are going up the hill. In a geographic sense, what is more enduring than a mountain, huh? Whether you calculate the Grand Teton Range to be some 6,000 or 6 million years old, they have endured throughout the time of mankind. That is the sense in which the psalmist makes an analogy to God's faithfulness. It is like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. This is why we derive our title from the text, Redoubt. Redoubt. What is a redoubt? Oxford English Dictionary defines it as a temporary or supplementary fortification, square or polygonal, and without flanking defenses. Oftentimes the flank would be covered by a mountain. We see this in the Two Towers, do we not? At Helm's Deep was a redoubt for the men. Redoubts were considered to be sturdy last lines of defense against offensive assaults by an enemy. When all else failed, the desperate defender of his home or castle or family and church repaired to the redoubt. There he would find his wife and children and clan, in the case of the Scots. And Zion would be the redoubt for Israel. Remember, Israel lies on the crossroads of the Middle East, a narrow intersection between Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Arabia, with only the Mediterranean Sea on her west and the Arabian Desert in the east. The narrow corridor formed by Israel pinched all travelers into this region, whether it be a caravan of traders or Egyptian armies on their way to Assyria, or vice versa, as happened all through the biblical history, right? I lived for 2 years at a very busy intersection in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the corner of State and Packard. Anybody from Ann Arbor would nod their head and say, oh, yes. It was a mixed blessing, too. We had everything we needed within a half block of our house. We were a few blocks from Michigan Stadium, too. So all of the crowds passing by our house on game day, it was fun. But heavy traffic, accidents, sirens, loud, lewd people at all hours of the day and night was a weary routine, too. Glad to be out of the big city. It was not uncommon in those days to have panhandlers knock on your door at night. Well, as we observe from biblical history, Israel had the nations of the earth swirling through her land constantly. More or less belligerent and demanding, these armies were a persistent threat to her, as we've seen in our Old Testament text today. Mount Zion is one of the central hills in Jerusalem. Taken by King David from the Jebusites, it became the promised place of rest for the Ark of the Covenant, did it not? In addition to being the site for the construction of the temple, Zion was also considered to be the last place of refuge, too. A true redoubt for the people of God. If you read Josephus, and once again, I plug him because he gives us a real insight into the background of Israel at this time. If you read Jerusalem and the siege by Titus, the Roman general, and his men of Jerusalem, that was the very last place to which all repaired in defense was to Mount Zion in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. Ravaged and destroyed, razed, of course, by the Romans. This is why we see, though, the language of our text. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, a sturdy and dependable redoubt, if you will, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. And, of course, we extrapolate from the earthly Zion, the heavenly Zion. And there's a very real sense in which this is true. That the heavenly Zion in particular abides forever, does it not? So, to Israel, Zion became the perfect analogy of safety and protection. And then by extension, too, we see in our text the surrounding hills of Jerusalem. Nearby mountains, including Mount Hermon, also provide security and protection from invading armies. Makes it much more difficult, does it not? Why do you think Switzerland survived 2 world wars, right? Unscathed, because of their mountainous topography. Why do you think Debbie and I moved to the Teton Valley, surrounded by mountains? Clear line of fire from our place, too. Oh, yes, I was asked that. I was asked that when we bought the place. Clear line of fire? So by analogy then, if indeed Mount Zion as a mountain is a sturdy place of refuge, a true redoubt, by analogy, we can trust the enfolding protection of God. We can entrust to God our safety, our protection. He always has us in the hollow of his hand. Sturdy indeed. So, can you see why this was a favorite of the Scots? Especially the Highlanders. Topography characterized by rugged mountains. Beautiful, too. It is stunningly beautiful. If you ever get a chance to visit Scotland, one of our neighbors vacationed in Scotland, and they were just saying how beautiful it was and how they wanted to go back. Wild, too. It's still a wild place. Moors and mountains and lakes. Characterizes not only the topography, though, but also the Scots' character. Know anything about the Scots? The Scots were indomitable, sometimes to a fault. The term clannish derives from this race of scrappers. When they weren't fighting the English or the Irish or the French, they were fighting amongst themselves, the clans of Scotland. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of romantic to preach about it and talk about it sometimes, but when you read the history, sometimes it's just brutal, senseless stuff, too. After the Battle of Pinkie, for example, 2 clans had at each other just after being beaten by the British. The Scots settled the backwoods of Kentucky and Tennessee, regions of the South. They brought that same clannish culture with them, though. The Hatfields and McCoys, right, defines clannishness in America. They were Scots, clans fighting amongst themselves. One Jewish comedian says this about them. He says, look at the Scottish guys wearing kilts. You could laugh at them, But the way they carry themselves and look at you, how can you and survive a sound thrashing? And an Irishman says of the Scots, only to a Scotsman can two positives make a negative. Well, this rough, scrappy nature did serve them well during the Reformation. Indomitable. No one epitomized the Scottish character more than its preacher, though, John Knox. Here's how one Roman Catholic, I had several quotes I wanted to give you on Knox, but I had one here by a Roman Catholic scholar who, you could tell just from his history, despised the Reformation period, despised the Reformers and Knox in particular. He says of Knox, see if you can discern this. He's trying to write an objective history. His sermons were more stirring and inflammatory than ever. He seemed possessed of an almost demonic power. All over Scotland, in Perth, at St. Andrews, in Stirling, and Linlithgow, excited mobs, inflamed by his eloquence, set to work breaking up churches, smashing altars, destroying religious statues and pictures. The scene seemed set for civil war. Well, one man's reformation is another man's civil war, isn't it? What the author MacLean, he's Scots himself, Scots Catholic, what MacLean plays down is the brutality and intrigue on the part of all around who wanted a piece of Scotland. France, with whom Mary hoped to ally and make of Scotland a virtual Catholic province of France. Queen Elizabeth, who rightly feared Mary's aspirations to her throne in England. Elizabeth's motto was, strike or be stricken. Strike or be stricken. And indeed, she not only struck out at France, but also struck out at Scotland, too. So, all around them. The Irish, too. The Irish, who just plain hated their mortal enemies, the Scots, they were ready to ally with England or France if they could kill some Scots in the process. So they had had their martyrs like Hamilton and Wishart. And while ready to die for his faith if necessary, Knox would nevertheless fight to preserve his faith and his precious kirk. He's famous for saying, a man in the right with God is a majority. So the Scots thus made a Reformation with God as their redoubt. How about you? We can take example from the Scots, can we not? There are times when we need to lay down the book and take up the sword, as Knox would say. Chaplain to the Confederation of Clans at this time. How about you? Are you ready to stand for your faith? Are you ready to preach like a demon, if you will, as the Catholics would say? Well, God will be your redoubt when you do. As verse 3 points out to us, redoubt. Principially, God has ordained the righteous to rule righteously. Verse 3 kind of forms the center, the heartbeat of this psalm. Redoubt. Principially, God has ordained the righteous to rule righteously. Our psalm derives a logical conclusion from the premise. For, verse 3 begins. For indicates that, for is a deductive preposition, by the way, and it indicates that there is a high moral ground upon which the psalm bases its confidence in the redoubt which God supplies. There is a moral high ground upon which the psalm bases its confidence in the redoubt which God supplies. The scepter of wickedness. Colorful metaphor, is it not, in the Hebrew? Colorful metaphor for evil rulers who rule on principles of evil. The idea that such men will not forever hold sway is communicated by the notion that their scepter shall not rest on the land. The tense of this verb is continuous. That is, the scepter of the wicked shall not continuously rest on the land. Though it may prevail for a time, it will not do so forever. God will see to it This gives us confidence that indeed our God is a redoubt, that though evil may prevail for a time, it shall not do so forever. Israel saw it. Though Israel found herself oppressed by the Philistines throughout the period of the judges, saw this last week, she would lapse into sin and idolatry and fall under the sway of the Philistines, repent, and then what God would give her judges to deliver her. As we saw in our text today, though Assyria swept through Israel like a hot knife through butter, right to the gates of Jerusalem, Zion proved a sturdy redoubt, did it not? And Israel was delivered by God. Though wicked kings ruled during the period of the divided monarchy, God cleansed the land by exile and then brought Judah back to reestablish the nation. So we see time and time again that indeed evil will not rule principally over the long term. It is a principle enduring into eternity that God will rule in righteousness. He has promised this. One of my favorite verses from the Old Testament, "He has told you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice?" Tzedek, same word, root-wise, for righteousness as well. "But to do justice, righteousness, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." The promise is that indeed God will rule the earth one day in righteousness, complete righteousness and justice. Jeremiah says, "Let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness." That is a continuous tense in the Hebrew as well. The Lord who practices, that is continuously practicing, establishing, making sure, making firm, steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. "For in these things I delight," declares the Lord. The promise is that God will indeed establish righteousness in all the earth, as the Psalms and the prophets so earnestly assert time and again, do they not? This psalm details one of the reasons. Lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. Indeed, in the purity code of Leviticus, we know it is the profane that contaminates the sacred, right? Not vice versa. The age-old play of Adam and Eve and the serpent is reprised every time evil looks good to us, but in the end debilitates, destroys, and kills, does it not? Nowhere is this more evident than in the exercise of power. The exercise of power. So tempting, isn't it? You just see good men go bad once they get power. Best test of character, as Peter points out. Best test of character, what will he do with power? Why do we find so much evil in government again? Right? Dillinger was asked, "Why do you rob banks?" "Because that's where the money is." "Why there's so much evil in government?" "Because that's where the power is." So do you see why the Scots sang this psalm as they went into battle and then rejoiced in victory? Especially with the coronation of James I. James I would be king of Scotland and England. And we see, if you read the history of that period, what power did to him. With the wicked plots and machinations of the French, the English, the Irish, the Scots, especially Knox, sought a peaceful form of church government. And they gave us Presbyterianism in the process. They sought a peaceful, prosperous form of civil government too. And they based this on the Republican model, small R republicanism, a republic established in Scotland amongst the clans. In fact, Knox preached his coronation sermon on the text from 2 Kings too, that describes the overthrow of wicked Queen Athaliah. Obvious analogy to Mary, Queen of Scots. And, of course, the establishment of the lawful, righteous King Joash, ostensibly hopes for James I. Knox's charge to James was, The scepter of your kingdom is the scepter of righteousness, borrowing from Psalm 41 and Hebrews chapter 1. The scepter of your kingdom is the scepter of righteousness, hoping indeed that his rule would be one of peace and righteousness. So it is with us. So shall it be when Christ returns. The author of Hebrews takes this very psalm, Psalm 45, and applies it to Christ. But of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions, talking about Christ. So indeed, he will rule in righteousness. God will extend his kingdom and do so in complete, perfect justice and righteousness. So do not despair when you see the wicked prosper. It will only be for a time. The scepter of evil will not rest upon the land forever. God will establish his kingdom in righteousness. We need this message today, do we not? Do not despair when you see the wicked prosper. His scepter will not rest on our land either. All right. Offensively, now, we take the offensive as well. From our redoubt, we sally forth. The righteous sally forth to victory and peace. Shalom. The believer can go forward with confidence, therefore, knowing that God will do good to those who are upright in their hearts. We can sally forth from our redoubts to conquer. The land will be taken. The evil will be led away for execution. In the end, there will be shalom for Israel and God's own. And this, of course, Hebrew word shalom, we hear from time to time, and we don't always understand what it means. We think we know what peace is. Supposedly, according to our present administration, there is a Pacific tone to the world now. The winner of the Peace Prize from several years ago has made peace throughout the world. Even though everybody is scared that ISIS is going to be around the corner to cut your throat and bring us another 9/11, these kinds of things, the world is in turmoil. If you think there is peace in the world, then I have a bridge to sell you in Manhattan. The believer, however, can go forward with confidence, and there will be true shalom in the land, not just surcease from hostility. Shalom means also prosperity, peace with God first and foremost. We have that now in Christ. And that there will be indeed a thorough shalom, peace between brothers and sisters, love between brothers and sisters. That's the nature of shalom, in Hebrew anyway, not just a ceasing of hostilities. And this would be true in Scotland for a period. The Scottish Parliament commissioned Knox to compose Confessions, a form of government, and of course the result was the Confession of Faith of Scotland. In the first book of discipline, which is also called Knox's Liturgy. And then this, in turn, was heavily resourced at Westminster. Everybody, all the Westminster divines, had Knox's material right at their elbows. So we owe a lot to Knox and this first establishment of a republic and a church, a Presbyterian system. Don't take it for granted. It was bought with blood and suffering and persecution. All right? By these sturdy Scots. And it would be almost 100 years until the Reformation was secure in Scotland, too, with the ascension of William and Mary in 1688, the Peaceful Revolution, that's known as. But keep in mind, you know, we take for granted that we worship here in peace and security, and that Muslims aren't going to come sweeping down on America, raise the black flag of ISIS over the White House, and ban all churches and establish mosques all over the land. Could happen, I guess. But it's not an immediate threat, is it? And we haven't had that kind of immediate threat in our history. We take these things for granted. But the Reformation, just because it had been made and established, was not certain and secure. And it would not be for another 100 years. The Reformers were always, the Scots were always looking over their shoulders for the English and the French to reimpose either the Church of England or the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church. So the rough and tumble character of the Scots and men like John Knox would serve them well. Seeing two positives make a negative, because you never know. The French may be here. England may invade again, as they did several times. But Mary, Queen of Scots, she was very charming. She was very pretty, very charming, and very persuasive. And she did make inroads into Scotland during this period. She had 4 interviews with Knox. Knox records these. In these interviews, she would apply all of her charms and all of her persuasive powers to try and win him over. But found in the end that he was just as stubborn as ever. And she had to say, "I fear the prayers of John Knox more than an army of 10,000. She would have to say in the end. This sturdy, rough and tumble Scots nature served them well and serves us yet. We owe much to the Scottish Reformation, brothers and sisters. Because we, as I've warned you many times, I get some raised eyebrows, but we are entering dark days. And as we do, make God your redoubt, your place of retreat, because he indeed protects you, and you won't find the grace of this until those days do come, and you feel the bite of them, you feel the pressure of them, you feel the shadows of those dark days beginning to come over us. Until you do, you will not know God as your redoubt, your true redoubt indeed, until that pressure is applied. But when it is, remember this psalm, it is yours now, it belongs to the church, it belongs to the life of the church. We can embrace it and sing it, can we not, with true hearts. Psalm 125, use this psalm as did the Scots. Well, let us now then come to that place where we find a true redoubt for our souls in the presence of the Lord, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.